Right, we're all set. So, we began the theme of Hubble and planets at the end of my last time with you, 2 weeks ago. I'd intended to carry on that story last week. So I've by and large just left the slides as they are, because we'll hopefully make up some ground to account for the lost week. This is a slide which I put together for a schools talk I was doing just 2 weeks ago. So that number might well have changed, and I had meant to check before I came out to see if it had, because we're finding planets thick and fast, and almost every other week the number is increasing, but at least on February the 4th that was up to date. And the website that this is taken from is run by the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, affiliated to Caltech, California Institute of Technology, and run by NASA. And basically, if you do a web search for Planet Quest, then you'll find it, and I'll put a link on the course website to it as well, so that you can have a wee look for yourself. It's a wealth of all sorts of useful information, not at all just about the Hubble telescope, because for all this course is about HST, and we will focus a bit on how HST has helped with planetary detections and observations, it's a much wider story than that, and actually it's a task which is being undertaken by some really quite small telescopes in the ground, because you don't necessarily need to have the biggest telescope around to detect extrasolar planets, but what you've got to be able to do is to analyse a lot of data in a short time, because you don't necessarily know which of the many stars you look at is going to be the one that happens to reveal itself as having a planet around it. And you've got to be able to analyse that data very quickly, because ideally you want to be able to process this virtually on a day-to-day basis. If a star shows some signs of having a planet one night, you want to be able to monitor it the next night and see whether your hypothesis is correct. So I want to begin by just explaining in a wee bit more detail exactly how that all works. How do we know that there are planets to begin with going around other stars? And then as part of that story, we'll see how the Hubble telescope has played a role. Oh crikey, that's a tough question. I don't know would be the honest answer, but my suspicion is that since we live in a fairly metal-rich part of our galaxy, and since most of the planets have been detected on fairly nearby stars, that the answer is probably either none or very few. But I'll check. But the fact that we live in a part of our galaxy where the metal content, that's, remember I talked about the astronomer's periodic table, it's like hydrogen, helium and everything else. So when we talk about metals, we're just meaning any of the heavier elements. Well, that is, you know, that's really a whole topic in itself. You know, why do we happen to live in a metal-rich part of our galaxy? Maybe it's somehow tied up with the very fact that we're here in the first place. But one message that I think I said at the end of the last session is that if you're going to look for life on other planets, then a good place to start is for looking for planets like our own. And I'll say more about that later. So, see, I'm not sure, Brendan, but I think the answer would probably be no, but I can check that out. Simply because of distance, but it's not entirely true that we only find planets in our immediate neighbourhood, because there's one method called microlensing that does let you find planets which are further away, but it's quite hard to determine what the properties of the star that the planet's going around is. But we'll see why that should be a bit later when we talk about microlensing as a way to find planets. Okay, so anyway, it's a highly active field, so just to give you a sense of that, it was 330 odds just a few weeks ago. In the year 2000, we'd only found 29. And in the year 2005, it had gone up to 136. So it's a growing number. And these graphs, I've got lots of little figures on that are probably way too small to see. But maybe the one thing you can notice is that they have a tendency to be curving out the way. Okay, that's fairly clear. Now what that indicates is the distance that the planets are from their parent star. And we measure this in astronomical units, which happens to be a sensible unit for our own solar system. One astronomical unit is the distance from the Earth to the Sun. So the Earth would be at one unit in that graph. It would be in here on the right-hand graph. So what this is basically saying is that at first, because these are arranged in chronological order, we generally were finding planets that were very, very close to their parent star. But as time wore on, we've got gradually better at finding planets which are further from their parent star. Actually, I should correct myself. These aren't strictly arranged in chronological order, because otherwise you'd think it'd be a bit weird. Why do you never find any more that are close? They have been arranged in increasing distance from their parent star. But actually, there's quite a strong relation, or correlation, as scientists would say, with the time at which they're discovered. The bottom line is, we're getting better at finding planets which are further away from their parent star. And in the course of the next half hour or so, I hope you'll see the reason why that should be. The other thing you can't see, because the numbers are too small, is what mass these planets have. How massive are they? The numbers are in multiples of the mass of the planet Jupiter, and most of the numbers are pretty big. But again, we're getting better at finding less massive planets, and I'll explain how that works as well. So as I say, if you want an up-to-date summary, there's various places to look. The PlanetQuest website's a good one. Here's another website, www.exoplanets.org. That's another place where you can find all of this information conveniently summarised. And the bottom line is, as I said, we're now finding less massive planets which are further from their parent star. And another thing you can maybe note from this diagram, if you look very closely, you can see that some of these systems involve multiple planets. So that's another hallmark of the last few years, that we're starting to find planetary systems which have got more than one planet. That shouldn't be too surprising, because after all, our sun's got quite a few, so why shouldn't other stars as well? So how has all this been possible? Well, let me first of all tell you how it's not done. Finding extrasolar planets is not simply a matter of getting your telescope, having a look, and just seeing the planet. The reason is that planets don't shine by themselves, they just reflect light from their parent star. And as we've just seen in the previous diagram, at least at first, we were generally finding planets that were very close to their parent star. So they're going to be drowned out by the light of their parent star. So even the world's biggest telescopes, like say the Keck reflectors that we saw in the first couple of weeks, or the current record holder for an individual mirror, is 10.4 metres, that's the big one in the Canaries that's recently opened. Those are simply not big enough to directly image planets going round another star. They're drowned out by the light from the star itself. There are proposals. Anyone know what the acronym OWL stands for? Overwhelmingly large. In fact, a more common terminology is ELT, which is extremely large telescope. But for a few years, people were kicking around some ideas as to just how big these might be. We've reined in our expectations just ever so slightly. When I first put this slide together in about 2004, there was a design study being undertaken by the European Southern Observatory to build a telescope where the mirror was 100 metres across. Of course, made out of lots of small mirrors, not a single mirror. But now, I think more realistically, you might remember I talked briefly about the giant Magellan telescope. That's going to be about 30 metres across. So we've scaled down a bit. But part of that design study for the overwhelmingly large telescope was, what kind of science could it do? And one of the things that it was projected that it could do is it would be able to detect planets directly. And here's to give you an idea of what would be involved. Imagine that we were building an OWL telescope on a planet 30 light years away, and we were looking at our sun instead of the other way around. What would you see? Well, you certainly wouldn't see the Earth, because it'd be in here, still completely lost in the glare. But you would at least stand a fighting chance of directly imaging the planet Jupiter, which is 5 times further away from the sun than the Earth is. So, if you want to directly image planets, then you need a stupidly large telescope, if I invent another acronym, an SLT. But even at that, you would still really struggle to see a planet like the Earth. Now, it's still already interesting to be able to directly image things like Jupiter further out. But if you want to look for life like us, then it's a bit cold out there. So the holy grail has been to detect Earth-like planets close into the star where you would have liquid water and you might have life like us. You're not going to see those directly. Not for the foreseeable future. So that's how not to find extrasolar planets. As I said, the Giant Magellan Telescope, I think I featured that slide in the early lectures. The proposals are reasonably firm for when this might be built. Within the next decade, this should be built. sites have been identified. It looks like it's going to be in Chile. And you can get some size of the scale from the wee person there. There you've got a reasonable chance to directly image big planets which are far from the star, but not Earth-like planets close in. So how can you do it? You can see the planet, see in inverted commas, because of the effect it has on its parent star. Basically, the parent star is wobbling because the planet and the star are actually orbiting each other. We talk about the Earth orbiting the Sun, but that's not really true. The Earth and the Sun are both orbiting their common centre of gravity. And a very good analogy for that is a seesaw. So something a bit scary is going to come out of Newton's mouth in a minute, but say, don't worry about the details of the equation, but we've all heard the myth where he was sleeping under the tree, the apple falls on his head, and he comes up with the theory of gravitation. What the equation is basically saying is that everything attracts everything else in the universe. And that means that just as the Earth is attracted towards the Sun by its gravity, so the reverse is true. The Sun is attracted towards the Earth by our gravity. But because the Earth's a lot less massive than the Sun is, consequently, the balance point between the Earth and the Sun is much closer to the Sun's centre than it is to us. Think of a seesaw, the best analogy really. So we'll just let this wee animation run, and we've got our seesaw in the foreground to make us think of a more down-to-earth analogy.
Do you call this astrometry?
No, not quite. Almost. Just bear with me. Yes and no, but you know, but first and foremost, we're not at the point of thinking whether it would be astrometry or not, but we'll be there shortly. Just think of the seesaw first. Let's just think about the underlying physics of it first of all. I know maybe some of you think, I didn't sign up for a course in physics, I signed up for a course in astronomy, but you couldn't have one without the other. So let's just stick to seesaws for a minute. If you've got a seesaw where you've got equal masses on both ends, then the balance point is exactly halfway in between. Whereas if you've got a much more massive thing at one end, like me and my daughter at the other end, for example, then it's not going to work unless I'm much closer to the middle. So that's basically the principle we have here. So the star and planet are going to orbit around their common centre of mass, or commonly also known as their centre of gravity. So as you can see, the star's moving a wee bit and the planet's moving a lot. So now to come to Bernard's point, you know, which is a good one, but I just didn't want to get ahead of myself here. If we take the planet away, in other words, we assume that it's too faint to be observed, then you could still tell it's there if you could measure the wobble of the star. So the basic physics principle it's based on is the seesaw, which comes from the idea of Newton's law of gravity. But the key question is, how large is the wobble? And the hope might be, so now we bring the astrometry in, astrometry is the phrase you would use to measuring very, very precisely the position of objects in the sky. So, okay, we can see this little red circle moving. So if we could measure its position and how it changes, we'd be able to deduce why it's moving and how massive the body is that's causing that motion. That would be an astrometric detection of an extrasolar planet. But the key question is, how large is that wobble and would it be possible? Well, let's take our example of Jupiter at 30 light years away again. We can work out how large the wobble is basically just by knowing what the mass of Jupiter is, the mass of the Sun, and then working out where the centre of mass is. We know Jupiter's orbit, so we know how much the Sun is wobbling by. The rather disappointing news is that that's only 1/3,000,000th the width of the full Moon, which is very challenging to measure. Now, in actual fact, as we know, there's more than just Jupiter in our solar system. So consequently, the wobble of the Sun induced by the planets isn't just a circular motion. It's more complicated. It looks a bit like a spirograph pattern. And that's because, of course, there's other planets than just Jupiter. So the wobble's mainly due to Jupiter. But depending on where the other planets are, if they're sort of reducing the tug of Jupiter because some of them are on the other side, or if they're enhancing the tug of Jupiter because they're all on the same side. Some of you might remember all these entirely fallacious websites that were claiming the Earth was going to be destroyed because all the planets were lined up in one side. You know, it's not that big an effect, believe me, but it is big enough to cause the movement of the Sun to follow a non-circular pattern. So that's what you would see if you could measure 1/3 millionth the width of the full moon from a distance of 30 light years, which is quite challenging. But there have been, over the last 5 to 10 years, space probes designed to do exactly that. One of them is called, first of all, just a wee comment on what that corresponds to. You know, science is often full of these little analogous facts, but they're not always terribly instructive. But if you imagine just what 1/3 millionth of the width of the full moon is, it's taking a 5 pence piece, and then, of course, as you know, as you move it further away, it looks smaller. Suppose you take it in a straight line, the equivalent distance to going all the way to Baghdad. That would be how wide this pattern is. So that's the kind of angles you're trying to measure. And yet, there's a mission called the Space Interferometry Mission, which over, you know, the time that I've been following this field, and, you know, I've been busy doing my cosmology, but I talk regularly to scientists who are more interested in finding extrasolar planets. And SIM is one of the missions, sometimes also known as SIM Planet Quest, which they have been pushing. Launch date, who knows, because basically it's been put on the back burner. NASA's had other priorities, including going back to the moon with people, or as some of my US colleagues used to put it, you know, Bush wants to go back to the moon, we only wish that he would, was what somebody said to me a few years ago. But you know what I mean? There's been a big push towards returning people into space. To be honest, a lot of the research astronomy community, while recognising that it's good for PR and that you can do some good science with human beings in space, would much rather have satellites like SIM looking for Earth-like planets if we had to make a choice. So it's certainly not currently possible. And because the launch date of SIM has been pushed back, well, it may be quite some time before we can measure the positions of stars with sufficient precision to be able to see them wobbling in this way. Okay? And remember, even that is just the wobble due to Jupiter, which is the most massive one. The wobble produced by a less massive planet like the Earth, at the Earth's distance from the Sun, would be less still. Okay? Although Jupiter's further away, it's a lot more massive than the Earth is, so it exerts a bigger wobble. So, effectively, that's another way you're not going to find extrasolar planets. You're not going to image them directly, and it's going to be hard to see Earth-like planets, at least, via the astrometric wobble. Although here I can put in a plug for HST, because the Hubble telescope has successfully measured the astrometric wobble of some extrasolar planets. But they've been rather special planets. They've been planets which are very much closer to their parent star than either the Earth or even Mercury is to our Sun. And they're very massive. They're what's termed hot Jupiters. So, stands to reason, they'll produce a much bigger wobble, and Hubble has been able to measure that. But if you're looking for Earth-like planets at roughly our distance from the other star, then even Hubble's not good enough. So how are you going to do it? Well, fortunately, spectroscopy comes to the rescue. We talked a bit about spectral lines in relation to the Hubble instrumentation. So let's just recap a little bit of what that's all about. Spectral lines are produced when light is emitted from atoms, when the electrons in the atoms change their energy level. I think in a previous week I spent a few seconds jumping up and down the stairs there, and I was pointing out that there's a fixed number of levels I can be at, and that spectral lines correspond to fixed amounts of energy being given off as the electrons jump down from high energy to low. So the spectral lines are a kind of fingerprint, or some people refer to it as like a barcode, that let you read off what chemical elements are present, but the spectral lines don't stay put. The spectral lines can move. So let's see how that all works. So again, we've got our star moving towards and away from the Earth this time, because instead of us looking at the star on the sky and it's moving that way, we're looking at it sideways on, so it's moving that way. So sometimes it's coming towards you, sometimes it's moving away from you. And I think I forgot to link the sound file. I meant to check that. Let's just see if we get any sound here. Missed the first few seconds of it, so we'll just start it again. It's, as Brendan says, it's the Doppler effect. This is sound file. I figured I might as well take one myself rather than just using it on the internet. One from the internet. A few years ago I was on sabbatical in the US and we stayed quite close to a railway line where frequently at 5 in the morning freight trains would pass through and wake us up. So I thought, well, if I'm going to have my sleep disturbed, I might as well at least put it to a good scientific use. And that's the Doppler effect. We all hear it when you hear police car sirens pass by, or even car engines, or, you know, racing car engines. I mean, again, you know, I don't know where kids pick this up from. They just innately got the sense that this is what the sounds do. Because, you know, I was at my daughter's nursery, and there was a couple of wee boys playing with racing cars, and they were going, "Nyeom!" like that, you know. Not sure if it was entirely accurate, you know, with the speed they were moving at, but they were getting the basic point. So just as sound does that, so does light. And that means that an object that's moving away from you will have its light stretched to longer wavelengths, and an object that's moving towards you will have its light squashed to shorter wavelengths. That changes the colour of the light. It's probably a concept that many of you are familiar with, and indeed we'll return to it in a few weeks, because we'll talk about the expansion of the universe. It's a subtly different effect in that case, but we still give it the same name. We talk about the redshifting due to the expansion of the universe. Well, redshifting in this case would be when the star is moving away. Blue shifting is when it's moving towards. So, that's what we want to measure. And we do it using spectroscopy. We do it using these spectral lines that we talked about earlier in the course. So, for example, you can take a triangular piece of glass, split the light up into its constituent colours. But what you really want is to have very precise measurements of what the colours or the wavelengths of light is. And the way that this comes about is because of this property of spectroscopy. For example, if we get what we call an absorption spectrum, that's when the little atoms in the atmosphere of your star or your planet are absorbing light of just the right energy required to make them jump to a higher energy level. And this all emerges from the weird and wonderful rules of quantum physics that say that the electrons can only orbit at particular distances from the centre of the atom. That's a somewhat oversimplified description, but more than adequate for our purposes. So a wee animation of that, it's just a cartoon, but if we think of the electron as a little planet orbiting, which we shouldn't really because it's actually a wave, but that's another story, then along comes some light, the electron absorbs that, jumps up to the higher energy level, the light is now gone. Okay? For our purposes, that's essentially all we need to describe what's going on. And that means that colour of light that corresponds to the precise energy difference between the innermost orbit, or the orbit the electron was on before, and the one it's on now, that is now missing. So that's why we call it an absorption line. It's a dark line. So here are some examples. Now, these were first detected in the spectrum of light from the sun. They were called Fraunhofer lines. And as I said a bit earlier, the colours that these absorption lines correspond to give a kind of unique fingerprint of what chemical elements are present. Indeed, helium was first detected in the spectral lines of the sun. Helium comes from the Greek word helios, meaning sun. We only later were able to recognise that, you know, we can have helium down here on Earth as well. So what you're basically looking for is these spectral lines. Sometimes they're absorption lines, sometimes they're emission lines. Doesn't really matter about the detail. What's important is that they're very well defined, and their position will change, their colour will change, as the light is either coming towards us or comes from a source that's moving away from us. So if we imagine with our telescope looking at a planet and a star orbiting their common centre of gravity, then even if the planet can't be seen, of course you can see it on the slide, but imagine you couldn't, and all you can see is the star, you would be able to deduce the presence of the planet from the periodic changes in the position of the spectral lines shifting from left to right as the star is coming towards us and moving away. Now, I think I put together a wee animation of this, which I thought was rather good. But maybe I didn't.
That explanation was initially contentious, wasn't it?
In what context? The explanation of the existence of...
the shift in the spectral line. Didn't somebody suggest that could also be caused by the star pulsating?
Oh, no, but that continues to be a bone of contention in many cases. I was wondering if you were referring to one particular example where some planets were suggested by the group at Jodrell Bank from radio observations of a pulsar. You might remember we talked a bit about pulsars before. That turned out to be just an artifact of their analysis methods. There really weren't planets there. But you're absolutely right. For many of the planetary systems where we believe a planet has been detected, it is possible that the star could be pulsating, but essentially it's very unlikely that it would be pulsating with that large an amplitude and that sort of period. Essentially, if you think about it, like say a swinging pendulum has a kind of natural period of oscillation that's really just determined by the length of the pendulum bob. So similarly with stars, there's a kind of natural oscillatory period associated with their internal behaviour. And indeed, we'll get onto this in subsequent weeks. I know we haven't got many weeks left, but one of the topics I want to cover is the Hubble telescope's contribution to finding Cepheid variable stars in other galaxies. Now, Cepheids you might have heard of before. Cepheids are pulsating stars. But the typical period of pulsation is of order a few weeks, because the size of the object, just like the length of the pendulum bob, effectively determines what's the natural oscillating frequency. Now, I didn't bring one, or I could demonstrate this, but say you had like a plastic or a metal ruler. You know, I'm sure we've all done it at school. You sort of twang it off the end of the desk. It will make a noise. The pitch with which it vibrates depends on how long the ruler is. So it's exactly the same principle. Now, the period of oscillation that we're talking about for planets going around stars is like months or even years. And one might have oscillations in the star with those very long timescales, but you wouldn't expect them to have such a large amplitude, because the internal mechanics of the star, it would just wouldn't make sense for you to have large amplitude fluctuations with such a long period. So it's much more reasonable to suppose that it's something external to the star. I mean, you've still got to be mighty careful that it's not just some error in your analysis, but it doesn't seem likely that for many of the long period planets that have been detected, that it's just the star masking that behaviour or mimicking that behaviour. Okay, so that's a very good question. And it does emphasise the fact, as I was saying a few minutes ago, that because you don't directly image these planets, can you really be sure that they're there? Well, as we'll see, there are some ways that you can cross-check, but it's still a challenge. It's not as easy as just turning your telescope and there you see an image of the planet and everyone believes it's there. Okay, so anyhow, how is this all done in practice? With either a prism, or more commonly, a sensitive device called a diffraction grating, and it's diffraction gratings that one has on the Hubble telescope instruments, for example, splits up the light into its constituent colours, and I've got one equation for you, hopefully not too scary. It's just to emphasise what this depends on. Lambda, this is the Greek letter lambda, so the lambda zero denotes the wavelength the light would have if the star weren't moving, or equivalently the wavelength you would measure if you just did all of this in the laboratory with spectral lines mimicking that from the star. Delta lambda, as we would say, is the change in wavelength caused by the motion of the star. And delta lambda divided by lambda naught, the Doppler formula says that that's equal to the speed of the star, or the radial velocity, to give the more correct term, that's the velocity along the line of sight, towards and away, divided by the speed of light. Now the speed of light's a big number. So unless the star is moving away and towards us with a big speed, then the shift in wavelength is going to be very, very small. So that's why this is a challenge. And that's why, really, the first planetary discoveries weren't made until about 15 years ago, or just less than 15 years ago. The science was very well understood, and in some ways quite old science from early 20th century, but the technology just wasn't up to it. The limits of current technology are very impressive, however. We can measure spectral line shifts at the level of about 1 part in 300 million. That means you can measure speeds of about 1 meter per second. So you're talking about the motion of the star towards and away from us, 1 meter per second. Or even I can run that fast. But of course I'm not going to be visible from 30 light years away. But that's the level we're looking at. Now, to return again to something that Brendan was saying there, it would be a real problem if the star were pulsating with that kind of frequency, but one wouldn't expect the pulsations to have as large an amplitude as is measured. And the other thing is, there's going to be random motions in the star's atmosphere. Some atoms will be moving that way, some will be moving that way. Those will certainly be as big as 1 meter per second, but that means you've just got to observe for a long time, because sooner or later the random motions will all kind of cancel each other out. But what you'll be left with is this periodic behaviour that just comes through overall. Now there's all sorts of clever mathematical methods that scientists use to study this. They go by names like, you know, Fourier transforms and all sorts of things. It's basically to pick out a periodic signal where you've got lots of noisy data, lots of inaccurate and rather randomly varying data. So it's a challenge, but it can be done. And this is what has led us to all these, or most of these planetary discoveries. Here's the first one. Discounting the two that turned out not to be planets after all, the ones that were going round a pulsar. But this one is going round a star called 51 Peg, just a regular star in the constellation of Pegasus. And in 1995, it was found to display a Doppler wobble of 55 meters per second. Now actually, what these little lines here are, if you're not familiar with these kind of graphs, physicists or astronomers would call these an error bar. It's a measurement indicating how precise our measurements are. So this was 1995, and as you can maybe see, the precision was only like 10 meters per second, whereas I was saying in the previous slide, we're now down about 1 meter per second. But remember I said we've got gradually better at finding planets which are further from their parent star, and also we've got better at finding smaller planets. In both of those cases, the wobble will be less. Therefore, if you want to detect the wobble, you need much more precise measurements. So the reason we could see 51 Peg back in 1995 is it's a whopping big amplitude of 55 meters per second. So even with these rather imprecise measurements, we could still see that it was actually changing, and it was changing in a very regular fashion. Okay? And what's shown along the horizontal is what's known as the phase, which is just a way of showing the periodic changes as it goes through one complete cycle. The phase goes from 0 to 1, and then it starts all over again. So that was 1995 technology, all ground-based, nothing involving Hubble at this stage. To show some somewhat more recent, this is from 2006, and these are radial velocity measurements which show a much more complicated form, because instead of it being a single planet causing the wobble back and forth, it's multiple planets. And remember the graph we had of Jupiter. It's worth going back again just for a moment. Come on. When you add in all the other planets in our solar system, instead of the Sun just performing a nice circle in the sky, Jupiter plus all the others, you get the spirograph pattern. Well, it's the same idea, but now we're tilting the system towards us. So remember, the motion is away and towards you. But instead of it just being a nice, smooth, regular circular motion, which translates in terms of the line of sight motion into, well, you, many of you, most of you will remember from your high school trigonometry, we call that a sine wave, a sine function. Well, it's now a lot more complicated. It's not a single sine function, but it's a whole bunch of them all joined up together, all convolved together. But what you see in the lower graphs is looking at what happens if you kind of subtract off one planet and look at what's left over. So here's the overall signal, here's what you get when you subtract off one planet, and here's what you get when you subtract off the next planet. So this is sort of isolating one single planet, but now the radial velocities are down at the level of about 1 or 2 meters per second. So essentially, you've got a big contribution from presumably a bigger planet, and then on top of that you've got a small wobble from multiple planets. And it gets pretty hard to reveal what's really going on. And like I say, although I don't work in this stuff directly, I was in Florida last October talking at great length to some people over there that do all this stuff, because the common theme is that I use a lot of sort of quite advanced data analysis methodology in my work, and it goes by the name of Bayesian inference, and it's well suited to answering the following problem. You know, how many planets are there in my data set? Well, in my case, it might be something else. It could be supernovae or galaxies or something. But, you know, you look at this. Well, how many planets are you supposed to fit to that? Is it 1? Is it 5? Is it 100? So Bayesian inference guides you in providing ways to determine, after you've fitted n planets, whatever number n happens to be, whether you've got any justification for fitting another one. So there's a lot of...
Mm-hmm.
Sure.
Which contains 3 Neptune-like planets.
So we think, yeah.
It could also contain 3 Earth-like planets.
Absolutely.
Right.
No, that's an excellent point. And the point is what...
Going back to the original, if you take the web page, which is exoplanets,
mm-hmm.
and it quoted in that web page that there were something like 280 stars and 300-odd
yep.
planets.
Mm-hmm.
The thing is, they could also have... None of which
are
Earth-like.
Yep. Well, I was going to go back, but you recall that. It said zero, a big fat zero in the Earth-like, yeah.
That's not to say they're not there.
Absolutely. It just means we haven't detected them yet.
Right.
Yeah, absolutely. And what is it? There's a classic phrase that was used in a very different context, but by Carl Sagan, which was absence of evidence is not evidence of absence. And that's very true here. And indeed, you know, you've put your finger on where the real challenge lies, because right now, the data we're dealing with is really very challenging. And therefore, the key question is, how far can I push this data in telling me what's really there? The planets don't stand out. First of all, we don't see them directly. We're having to deduce their presence indirectly. And I've made the case that right now, we just don't really expect we could see Earth-like planets. That doesn't mean they're not there. They could well be there. So we're always trying to sort of push the boundary a bit. And that's why this is a field that I've followed closely. Not that I work in it directly, but a lot of the statistical machinery that I use in my line of work is applicable in this field as well. All these, you know, has anyone heard of Bayesian inference before, just out of interest? It's not really something that gets too far out into the mainstream, but, you know, it's actually... Well, Bayesian statistics, it's often described as well, although that's a wee bit of a misnomer, because that's another story. It's used in a whole lot of fields. It can be used, actually, in analysing, you know, national lottery data, you know, all sorts of things. Yes, I imagine it's probably used in filtering, because effectively, it's not magic, you know. I mean, there's another commonly used phrase, garbage in, garbage out, and if your data aren't good enough, Bayesian methods aren't going to suddenly find a planet that isn't there. The point is, what it does is provide you with some general guidelines as to how far you can push the data you have and still have sort of credible conclusions. And, you know, that's why your point is a very good one, that if the signals you're really interested in are too faint to be detected, well, you simply don't know if they're there. They could easily be there, and you don't see them.
Does this data system cater for planets that are changing their orbit?
Well, the timescales over which we've been observing extrasolar planets are sufficiently short that we wouldn't expect that to be the case. However, let's take another example where, you know, I'm getting a wee bit off point here, but these are, you know, interesting questions. Those of you who came to the course last year on Einstein's universe may recall that one of the things we briefly discussed was the impact of general relativity on planetary orbits. Again, that's, you know, way off the main topic, but still of general interest perhaps, that what general relativity says is that the planetary orbits do in fact change. And Mercury, for example, its orbit is sort of gently moving around, precessing, we say, but at an incredibly slow rate, you know, 39 arc seconds, which is about, you know, a hundredth of a degree per century. So, you know, it's a tiny, tiny effect. But, I mentioned pulsars before, there's a binary pulsar system where the orbit is precessing very much more rapidly. And there's another system, a supermassive black hole system, which goes by the interesting name of OJ287, which if you do a Google search for OJ, you find a lot of other sorts of pages. But it's a black hole with another black hole orbiting it, and its orbit is precessing as well. So now, to answer your question, I've not done the analysis of these systems, but I know the people quite well who have done. And essentially what you do is, your Bayesian inference gives you a framework in which to do the following. You can test two models. One model is the orbit is changing, the other model is the orbit isn't changing. And you can work out what's called an odds ratio, a ratio of probabilities as to whether you should favour one model over the other. And, you know, for both of those systems, the odds are overwhelmingly in favour that the orbit's changing. So if you observed extrasolar planets for long enough, then you could test those kind of things. You could see, do I have evidence yet that the orbit's changing? You know, that's why these methods are so attractive to astronomers, because they allow us to construct in a kind of sensible, objective way answers to the kind of questions we're interested in. We don't just have to base it on a hunch or a feeling. We can work out a number and say, you know, I'm sort of very sure based on the evidence that this model is what I think it is. Don't get me started on Bayesian methods. I'm something of an evangelist for them, so that's a whole other ball game. But it is interesting how there are many problems which are quite common across a range of fields in astronomy. And see, this is one where, although I've not worked directly on detecting exoplanets, I've followed quite closely what's going on, because I think there are many hallmarks of it which, as a statistical problem, are very interesting. How do you really know how many planets are there? You know, it just looks like a bunch of squiggles on a graph. How are you going to go about determining that? That's where we need advanced machinery like Bayesian methods offer. Anyhow. Sure. No, not at all. These are... Yep.
You won't be able to detect the doppler shift.
If the planet's not in your field of view, or if the star is...
Absolutely.
Okay. Absolutely.
So you wouldn't see any of the period that you...
That's exactly right, yeah.
The other situation, if it's edge on to you,
yep,
you're very strong signal. So how can you tell the difference, but also that, how can you tell the difference between whether the solar system is on edge to you, or...
No, that is an excellent question. That is where the Hubble telescope has made the biggest contribution, actually. If you can bear with me, I've got one specific system where we'll look at exactly that point. But just before, it'll probably be after the break at this rate, but let me just briefly then take Mark's question and sort of summarise what the main issue is, because he's put his finger on something very important. So just to recap then, before we go into the break, we've talked about two methods where you might hope to detect planets. One, I said, was very difficult, but Hubble's managed it in a few isolated cases. And it's where the wobble is in the plane of the sky, as you would say. So basically the star's going round that way. But in that case, there's no motion towards and away from you. So you wouldn't see any Doppler shift at all. Whereas, as Mark has just said, the other extreme is where the Doppler shift is entirely in their plane and it's towards and away from you. Most cases you'd expect to be somewhere in between, a mixture of the two. How are you going to tell? Well, the essence of that we'll leave in detail till after the break, but let's just go back to the list here. And I know it's too small to see, but what you see here are estimates of the mass of the planet. Now, almost all of those estimates are based on the assumption that the orbit is doing that. And if the orbit's tilted, then your inferred mass will be wrong. So what you're actually inferring is the mass times the sine of the inclination of the orbit. Now, if the orbit is inclined at 90 degrees, that's how it's measured, so it would be that angle would be 90, then sine of 90, if you remember all that from high school, is 1. So you get the correct mass. But if it's tilted, then you're going to be out by a factor of sine I. And in fact, essentially think of it like this. You know, what you measure is the component of the motion of the star backwards and forwards. So if the orbit's highly tilted and you're measuring that much, then actually it must be going a lot faster because you're only seeing a little part of it. Okay? Therefore, if you work out the mass of the planet required to make the star wobble that much, but the star's actually wobbling a lot more, then that would mean that the planet would have to have a much bigger mass. Does that make sense? Okay, so we'll return to that. These are the minimum masses. Now, how you might tell is if you can also observe the star wobbling. Okay? So for that, you require very, very precise measurements, and that's where the Hubble telescope has been useful. Not at detecting the systems, but at following them up. Once we know, or at least we think there's a planet there, you can then go and look and see if you find a wobble, which will help you to, that's an astrometric wobble, to use the term that Brendan introduced, rather than a Doppler wobble. And the combination of the two may allow you to break that uncertainty. So that's an excellent point. So we're coming to that after the break. Let me just lead into a short break then, and see we've got some things to think about, by mentioning the other method that's most common for finding planets. So we've got Doppler wobble, we've got one or two isolated cases where it's the astrometric wobble, and that's probably going to be very important in the future. The third one is called the transit method, and it's pretty similar to the idea that gives us eclipses, because when the moon passes between us and the sun, you can have a total solar eclipse. Now, the fact that the moon appears just the right size to cover the sun is just a coincidence. Well, you know, I guess so. What else can it be? I don't really think it's got any bearing on us evolving here on Earth, so you couldn't see it as some kind of, you know, anthropic principle selection effect. I don't know. But it is a curious thing, the fact that the moon just happens sometimes to be able to cover the whole sun, despite the fact that it's a lot smaller. It's just because it's a lot closer to us. Well, a few years ago, there was a transit of Mercury. Same basic idea. Mercury passes between us and the sun, but because Mercury's a lot further away, of course it looks a lot smaller. And that's Mercury, and that's a sunspot. And these are some colleagues at the Glasgow Science Centre. They had a sort of an open day that day, let the public have a look at this. They're looking with a little sunspotter telescope, and over the course of a few hours, the sunspot basically stayed put, but Mercury crossed the sun's disk. Now, if we had been able to measure the brightness of the sun precisely enough, we would have seen a small change in the brightness as Mercury crossed, because Mercury was blocking out a little bit of the sun's disk. The effect's a lot more dramatic for a solar eclipse. It gets dark, moreover it gets quite cold for a few minutes because the sun's light is being cut off. But with precise enough measurements, you can still see it even for that case. Another more recent and perhaps even more famous example, there was a transit of Venus on 8th of June 2004. I was up in Skye at a conference and did manage to see it up there. But this is a series of images taken in Italy. And some of you might know that transits were a big deal in astronomy in the past because we could use transits of Mercury and Venus to measure how far away the sun was. But now we have other ways to do that. But transits are still of interest because we can look for transits of extrasolar planets. So the principle is exactly the same. Planet comes along, crosses in front of the star, which in this case isn't the sun. So you can't see it directly, but you can see the effect it has. It makes the brightness of the star take a dip. And there's been numerous examples of this now observed. And perhaps one of the most beautiful examples is with Hubble. So this is the light curve, as we call it, of a star. I forget the star's number, but if anyone's interested, I can look it up. But basically, during the transit of the planet, it dips. And in fact, the curvature of the dip is because the planet, as it begins to cross the star, well, just a little bit of the planet will be crossing the disk, and then more and then more. And the exact curvature can even tell you something about the planet's atmosphere. So this is a very powerful method. Moreover, it has the distinct advantage that once you've seen a transit happen, you could perhaps then anticipate when the next one's going to be, as you gradually work out what the orbit is. And therefore you can have an even better telescope ready to observe the next one. So we'll talk more about transits and what we've learned from them after the break. Okay, but that's a good point perhaps at which to stop. So we'll see you about 9:15. Alright, and I forgot to switch my voice recorder on. So not to worry, we've missed about 10 minutes. Hopefully nothing too crucial. So anyhow, that's what I want to just focus on for a little time now. The question of what would we look for? Well, basically the key ingredients are water, oxygen and carbon dioxide. These are regarded as the key signatures of life like us. Not that it's very relevant to the Hubble telescope, but it's maybe worth mentioning that an interesting exercise was carried out a few years ago. The Mars Express probe was sent by the European Space Agency to Mars, and it orbited the planet and it detected the presence of liquid water in the ice caps in frozen form. So I suppose I shouldn't say liquid water, but frozen water in the Mars and ice caps. But before it went to Mars, its spectrometer on board actually looked at the Earth. So in other words, what it was trying to see was, is there life on Earth? Now, of course, we know the answer to that one, I guess. But it was mimicking what maybe a passing space probe that aliens might have sent our way would be doing. Would you actually be able to tell there was life on Earth just by looking at a spectrum of the Earth's atmosphere? Well, what you see is absorption lines, just like we talked about before the break, that correspond to carbon dioxide and oxygen and water. Now, of course, if you're flying by the Earth close up, you've also got the chance to look down and you can see things like the Great Wall of China and all these other structures that indicate there's life here. But if you were very far away and all you had was a spectrum, you couldn't image the planet, but you could just tell what gases were in the atmosphere, which gases would be the telltale signs that we are here? Well, those are the three. And in fact, above all, it's really oxygen, because oxygen's a very reactive chemical element. So if it's not being continually produced by life, then it will just wind up getting locked up in other things like rust, for example, iron oxide. So the presence of free oxygen in our atmosphere is a very significant indication that there's life on Earth. Would we expect to be able to see that in the atmospheres of other planets? Well, you've got to be able to take a spectrum first, and that's a big challenge.
So I think it did find life on Earth.
It did, yeah. Good point. Actually, I can show you the slide. I'll bring it along next week, because it's one I've used in other lectures on, specifically on the topic of life on Earth. And the Mars spectrometer slide is quite revealing. Actually, I'll only take a moment. Maybe it's worth just digging it out now. It's quite instructive to see what it detected. I think it's probably in here.
If we found lots of free chlorine on another planet, would that suggest life?
Well, possibly, if it's a chlorine-based. I'm not really sure if I know enough about the astrochemistry here. It's a fair point in that chlorine is highly reactive. Let me talk to some colleagues about that. The person who's most likely to know the answer to that is my friend Helen Fraser, who's on the staff in Strathclyde and is an astrochemist. It could be that she would have a view. But I mean, I take your point. I hope nonetheless, whatever is the answer to that with regards to the chlorine, it still is. I mean, I think the answer is, well, put it this way, something would have to be producing that chlorine. Now, I'm not saying that that's chlorine-based life, but, you know, we happen to know that one very good way to produce lots of free oxygen is to photosynthesize it. So unless one could come up with another reason why there's lots of free oxygen in our atmosphere. The presence of life producing it is a good working hypothesis. I don't know whether there are other ways in which you could make free chlorine, but it's a good point. I'll ask Helen and see what she says. Let me just see if I can track this down for you. Life in the solar system, maybe that's what I want. Life solar. Lots of interesting slides, but not what I'm after. Let me leave that, but I will and dig it out for next week, because I know I've got it there somewhere. It's just it's hard to find. So it's the spectrum produced by the Mars Omega spectrometer on Mars Express. So what you see here is just a wee graph indicating how close you'd have to be to stars of different mass in order to have liquid water. So if you accept the argument, you know, it's just a particular point of view that says if we want to find life, a good way to begin is to look for life like us. It doesn't mean that there couldn't be other forms of life out there. It just means that we would find it harder to recognise. So if we're going to look for life like us and we're going to look for liquid water, then you need to look for a planet that's in the right distance range from its star for liquid water to exist. In the case of our Sun, which is, well, let me just use the pointer on the screen. In the case of our Sun, which is got a mass of 1 relative to the Sun's mass, then the Earth is bang in the middle of the habitable zone. If you're in a less massive star, a planet orbiting a less massive star would have to be much closer in order for liquid water to exist. If it's a much more massive star, you'd have to be further out. And in fact, there's a slight complication there as well. If you're orbiting a more massive star, then there could be issues with the star not being stable for a long enough time. And okay, maybe that's okay. We don't know that much about biology after all. We know how it happened in our planet and it took billions of years, but maybe it could happen much faster on another planet. So maybe we shouldn't rule that one out. But at the very least, it indicates that you're not going to expect to find liquid water very far away from a cool star or very close to a hot star. So if you want to look for planets for this liquid water and its solar-like stars, then you've got to be able to find them in this habitable zone. And the Doppler wobble method is not so good at doing that because the wobble won't be so big. It's good at finding planets which are much more massive and much closer in. But the Kepler probe to be launched on March 5th will be capable, if it performs to its design spec, of finding Earth size and even smaller than Earth size planets in the habitable zone. And it will do it by the transit effect. There's a wee cartoon in the corner representing that. So what it will be looking for is periodic dips in the brightness of solar type stars as Earth-like planets and even bigger planets as well cross in front of us. So watch this space. I mean, the class has got a couple of weeks to run after the space probe launches, but don't expect any dramatic new results. It's going to take quite some time to build up a picture of what's out there because there's a whole bunch of candidate stars, many of which have had planets detected by the Doppler wobble method. So that comes back to your point earlier. What this now might let us do is revisit some of the star systems where we know there's big planets, but we've no idea if there's smaller ones. But now we will have the capability, perhaps, to tell. At least we can try. I mentioned before the break this idea of hot Jupiters, which are very massive planets which are close into the star. They're easy to detect because they make the wobble bigger. But what kind of planets are they? Well, as the name suggests, they're very hot. They're Jupiter-like, which means they've got massive atmospheres of hydrogen and helium. But what you can also hope to detect is the presence of other chemical elements. So this is another very recent paper. This is from 2008, if I remember rightly. No, actually, this one's earlier, but there's been some follow-up work. 2004, that looks like. So the initial discovery was about 5 years ago. And it was oxygen and carbon that was detected. So how this worked is that during the orbit of the hot Jupiter, which was first of all detected by Doppler wobble from the ground, then Hubble was used to look for it transiting. And remember that during the transit, the planet is cutting off some of the light from the star, but the planet's surrounded by an atmosphere. So as the starlight passes through the planet's atmosphere on its way to us, some of that starlight can be absorbed. And depending on what chemicals are present in the atmosphere of the planet, that will determine what colours of light, what wavelengths of light get absorbed. Okay? So this is how you can tell what's there. And I know the graph looks a bit complicated, but what you see there is that it's the amount of energy, the flux as we call it, from the star when it's off transit. That means the planet isn't transiting, so we're seeing the whole of the star. And then the solid curve is when the planet's in the way. So you see there's a difference, and the difference depends on the wavelength of the light. That's like the colour of the light. And the pattern is such that at certain wavelengths or certain colours, you get features which are absorption. So see, this one here is produced by the dip between the star's light on its own and the star with the planet in the way. And that corresponds to where you'd expect to see a spectral line due to oxygen. So it's very indirect evidence. It's real sort of, you know, sort of CSI stuff almost. CSI, extrasolar planets. But what you're doing is you're detecting the likely presence of oxygen in the atmosphere of that planet because of the absorption that it causes from the star's light. So this is about, you know, where the state of the art currently lies. In principle, we can use the Hubble telescope to do spectroscopy on the atmospheres of extrasolar planets, but not Earth-like extrasolar planets. That would just be too hard right now. But there are plans to put bigger and better telescopes up there in the next 10 to 20 years that might well be capable of doing that. And if you find oxygen, carbon dioxide, water, well, it tells you something. And in particular, if you find the oxygen, it would, in many people's view, be a strong indicator that there could well be vegetation, at least, if not intelligent life. Okay? So to bring it back a wee bit to the present, here's a direct image of a planet taken with a Hubble telescope. It's actually a planet that's in the process of forming. This is the star Fomalhaut. Fomalhaut, always mispronounce that. And it's got a disk around it. It's a, you know, still just a star that's very young, and it's surrounded by sort of a debris disk containing lots of gas and dust from when the star's forming. And what Hubble has been able to do is to image that there's been a little change, that thing there has moved to there. So, okay, that indicates that the disk as a whole is moving. That's no great surprise. But it indicates that in the debris disk, there's something which may well wind up being a planet. But it's pretty big, because the scale of this, I'm not sure if I put a scale on it, did I? No, I didn't. The scale of this is way bigger than our own solar system, so you're not looking at an Earth-like planet either. You're looking at something that's quite far out. But it is, nonetheless, an indication that there are planets in the process of forming. Yeah, that's right, I did put the scale on. So the Fomalhaut system with this sort of ring of material around, well, if we scale that up, it lies, you know, it's outside even the orbit of Neptune. It's out in what we call the Kuiper Belt, where there's a lot of debris in our own solar system, which periodically throws in comets and things into the centre of our solar system. The Kuiper Belt objects are many and varied, and indeed we really think of Pluto now as a Kuiper Belt object, which is one of the reasons it got downgraded from being a full-blown planet to just a dwarf planet. Okay? So that's about where it all lies with exoplanets and HST. But what I'd like to wind up tonight with is just talking about one other method for finding extrasolar planets. And it's not a method that the Hubble telescope has played any major role in, but it will lead us into what we'll talk about next week, which is gravitational lensing, which the Hubble telescope has played a major part in. Okay, so I've just got time to talk about this a little. So gravitational lensing brings in some pretty wild ideas from Einstein's general theory of relativity. And those of you who did come along to the course last year will know that we spent many weeks talking about it, so I'm not really going to have long to just give you the flavour, just scratching the surface really. But let me try and describe what's the key ideas. Einstein's general theory of relativity predicts that gravity can bend light, that the path that light takes is not going to always be a straight line, that light, and indeed any massive object as well, is going to follow a curved path because space-time itself is curved. And the normal analogy that we draw, which is quite a good one, is to think of a stretched sheet of rubber, or a trampoline, say, into which you drop a heavy object, like a bowling ball. It will deform the surface of the trampoline, it will make it curved, so that then if you then take, say, a smaller ball, a golf ball or something, and roll it around, it will no longer follow a straight line path, it will follow a curved path. So should we believe any of this? Well, Einstein published the theory in 1916. And 3 years later, Arthur Eddington led an expedition to the island of Principe. Some of you might well have seen the BBC programme a few weeks ago. David Tennant played Eddington and Andy Serkis played Einstein. And I don't know if the historical sort of personal events were entirely accurate, but they got most of the science just about right, because what they described was Eddington's observations of a total solar eclipse. And what he was trying to do was to see whether stars that lay close to the sun on the sky would have their positions apparently changed because the path of the light as it passed close to the sun would be curved, just like my wee diagram's trying to represent. So the star would appear as if it's there, when in actual fact it's over there. Now this is greatly exaggerated, just to demonstrate the effect. But the reason you have to do it during an eclipse is that normally, if the sun and the star are in the same line of sight, you don't see the star at all, because the sun is too bright. But during an eclipse, because the sky is dark around the sun, then we can see the stars close to the sun on the sky. So I said before that I guess it's just some kind of weird cosmic coincidence that the size of the moon happens to appear to be the same as the size of the sun. Well, if nothing else, it lets you test general relativity, at least in 1919. So nature was kind to us. There's a number of great stories about this. Einstein himself had a rather withering remark about the Eddington expedition, not so much to do with Eddington, but his great friend Max Planck. He said that Planck was one of the finest people he'd ever known, but he didn't really understand physics, because during the eclipse he stayed up all night to see if it would confirm the bending of light. If he had really understood general relativity, he would have gone to bed the way that I did. So, as people have often said, Einstein would never let, you know, the observations get in the way of a good theory, but he was still pretty pleased, notwithstanding that sort of caustic remark, that Eddington's observations did seem to back up the theory of general relativity. And indeed it was published in the newspaper. There was reports in the New York Times and in the London Times within a few days of this, and I suppose from people of whom I've spoken to about this, of science historians, they reckon that this is perhaps as much to do with the fact that it was a German and a British scientist working together, because it was less than a year after the end of the Great War, rather than, you know, the editors of the New York Times appreciating the deep significance of the bending of light in a gravitational field. But nonetheless, GR has turned out to be of huge importance as a scientific theory, and a lot of its predictions might seem very esoteric and nothing at all to do with everyday life. But if somebody ever says that to you, then tell them that their GPS system wouldn't work without general relativity, because time runs quicker up there than it does down here. Closer to the Earth, the gravity field is stronger, time runs more slowly. It's a tiny effect, but it builds up and it builds up, and if you didn't take that into account, as the GPS satellites do, then they wouldn't work properly. So general relativity is very esoteric and very abstract, but it's also quite practical. Or at least it has practical applications these days. Didn't have many practical applications in 1919, but nonetheless, Eddington's observations supported the theory. More modern astronomical applications of general relativity include the bending of light from background galaxies. We'll get into more of this next week. As the light from those galaxies passes close to massive clusters of galaxies in the foreground. And here's a real prime example, a beautiful image, where these are background galaxies and their images are distorted, they're twisted and arc-like, rather in the way that you might focus light using a lens of glass. But this time the lens consists of matter. It's bending it because gravity does that. The presence of the matter bends space-time so that light will follow a curved path and you get distorted images. Now what's all that got to do with planets? Well, we're getting there. In some examples you can actually see multiple images. This is one known as the Einstein cross. It's a very beautiful example. What we're seeing here is a distant object called a quasar. We'll have more to see on those in a few weeks' time as well. And the light from the quasar is being bent and actually split into multiple images as it passes through a galaxy in our foreground. Now, how do we know it's all the same quasar? Well, I suppose at some level we don't know for sure, but we think it is because the spectrum of the quasar in all four cases looks virtually identical. And therefore we think we're looking at the same quasar but multiply imaged. There's a slightly bigger example. So that image, that one and that one are the same background object, but the light's coming to us along different paths. Okay? Looks maybe a wee bit easier when you see it as a negative. So the planet connection is because sometimes this happens when the lensing is only over a tiny angle and therefore you don't actually see the multiple images. They're too close together. But what you see instead is that the object that's being lensed is temporarily made brighter because of these multiple images. And then later it becomes fainter again. This we call gravitational micro-lensing, not lensing. It's essentially the same effect but just on a smaller scale, and that means that the brightening isn't dramatic, it's not big enough to see, you don't see individual images, but you just see a temporary brightening of the background object. So let's say you take a bunch of stars and there's a foreground object which we'll call a gravitational lens, which could be a star but maybe a star that's too faint to see, or a planet. Who knows what it might be? But it's sufficient in mass to bend the light from the background star and focus it. And then what you see is that temporarily the star will appear brighter as as the gravitational lens crosses our path. I mean, if nothing's moving, then you'd never know, because the background star would always appear the same brightness. But the key to this is that if the lens is crossing our path, then the background star will change in brightness. It will get brighter and then it will get dimmer. And that's how you know it's been lensed. So here's the sort of thing one sees. It's another example where you plot a light curve like we did for the transiting planets. For the transiting planets, you saw a dip. For a transiting lens crossing the line of sight, you actually see a brightening. And the shape of the curve tells you about the mass and the position of the object that did the lensing. So, most of the lensing events that have been observed, and there's been thousands of them observed now, we think the thing that's doing the lensing is a low-mass star. One that isn't really bright enough to be seen itself, but because the light from the brighter background star is passing very close to it, it makes the background star temporarily brighter. Well, what if that low-mass star had a planet going around it? What would happen then? Well, this is what we think would happen. That the background star would be lensed by the foreground one just as before, but then as the planet crosses our path, you would get another little bit of lensing. And actually it could be quite a big peak. In other words, the planet could magnify the background star almost as much as the foreground star did. But the difference is it would only do it for a very short time, because the planet's small and will only be close to our line of sight for a short time. The other big drawback is you don't get a second shot at this. The lens is gone. They've got to be in almost perfect alignment for this to happen. So, in many people's views, this is an interesting way to find exoplanets, but it's fraught with some controversy, because how can you be really sure when you never get another chance to look again? But nonetheless, that's kind of where we're headed. Another method of looking for exoplanets is to use microlensing. There's been some discovered from the ground already, but there are proposals which would put a dedicated satellite in space. Again, no firm launch date, but you know, I know a lot of the people involved in this. I have done some work in microlensing as recently as January. If I had made it to that conference in Paris, there was another one happening on microlensing in Paris the same week, and I was going to try and sort of get an update on what the latest was. There was a white paper, that's a kind of, you know, consultation document, a bit like what the government calls white papers, that NASA put out 2 weeks ago on finding planets with microlensing. So it's still on people's sort of long-term planning, but there's never enough money to do everything you want to do, and it could be that that will be some time before we have a space-based dedicated satellite to do this. But if we did, then in principle, you could look for Earth mass planets that way as well. But like I said, it's not without its critics, because you only get one shot at it. You don't get the chance to go back and look again the next time the planet orbits around, because that's not how you're finding them. You're finding them in a very different way. However, there have been some successes. There was the reported discovery of a 5 times the mass of the Earth planet in January 2006, and that still holds the record, if the observations are correct, of the lowest mass planet we've ever found. And you don't have any problems to do with these inclination effects here. You can get the mass very precisely. So there's the observations. So that's the star, the low mass star, not very bright star, little red dwarf in fact, crossing our line of sight and making the background star brighten. OGLE stands for Optical Gravitational Lensing Experiment, just, you know, one of these acronyms. And there's various collaborations that have been observing these things. And then this little blip here is the deviation due to a planet. And that was observed by many different observatories. And...
So were they all observing the same star?
Yep.
So, okay.
Yep.
The idea being that they don't all make the same mistake.
Well, kind of, but more importantly, the idea being that you get 24-hour monitoring, because when it's daylight somewhere, it'll be dark somewhere else. But it's also, you know, your point's a good one as well, that if there is some systematic problem with the telescope in one location that makes you think the star suddenly got brighter, but it hasn't really, it's just your CCD isn't working properly, then you wouldn't expect that to affect all the other observatories as well. So it's a good cross-check. But it's more important that you have continual coverage, because this is only happening over a few days. So you've got to really get, you know, you don't want to miss the crossing of the planet because it happens to be cloudy, or it happens to be, you know, happens to be daylight when it all happens. Absolutely. That's key to this. Essentially, they're looking at many, many stars. When you see a microlensing event beginning, then what you can then do is bring in a network that will do intensive follow-up of that star. So the OGLE experiment is doing the big-scale monitoring of millions of stars, and then once it was seen that a lensing event seemed to be happening, then other observatories were roped in. So it's a kind of network, and it's a very effective way to do it, actually. Okay? So, I'll leave you with this. This is a sort of artist's impression of what we think that planet might look like. Who knows what it really looks like? But the point is, the star it's orbiting is a red dwarf. And that means that this planet, if the microlensing observations are correct, is again not really a terribly good candidate for an Earth-like planet. Okay, it's got a low mass, but it's simply too far away. It'd be pretty cold. So it's interesting, and it's helping to, you know, just increase the range of methods at our disposal, but it still hasn't found the holy grail of an Earth-like planet in the habitable zone. So the quest for ET continues. It can do, it does require certain assumptions. It requires you to assume something about where the lens is. Details are a little bit technical, but basically the maximum magnification will occur when the lens and the planets going around the lens is exactly halfway between us and the source. Now it's quite hard to determine that precisely, but there are some ways you can do it, and one very clever way is if it's a long timescale microlensing event, then you can follow the event as the Earth goes round the Sun, and then you take advantage of what we call parallax. So the idea, if you cover first one eye and then the other, you see your finger shift, and that basically would allow you to work out how long your arm is. There's obviously easier ways to do it, but it's, you know, that parallax angle can let you do that, and that technique can be used in this case to help us work out how far away the star doing the lensing is, and hence how far away the planet is from the star. So that's all been done. Okay. So, we're almost out of time. I hate to keep the janitors waiting, but just time to show you this. I mentioned that you only ever get one shot at this. Well, you kind of do, but at least one thing that's been possible has been to do a little bit of follow-up. So another plug for HST and its great contribution here. This was an event observed by another one of these collaborations. This is called the Machel Collaboration. It's again a rather silly name, but the acronym is Massive Compact Halo Objects, which is, makes sense because you're looking for something compact like a star or a planet, which is contributing to the mass of the halo of our galaxy. It's all to do with dark matter, more on that in a couple of weeks' time. So this is the microlensing event, which happened in 1995. Well, is it a microlensing event? Well, one of the things that helps convince us is that you see the rise and then the fall, but you see it in both the R band, which is like red colour, and the V band, which is kind of yellowy-green colour. So microlensing should not depend on the colour, and that's borne out by this. But the thing that really helps to convince us is that the Hubble telescope in 2007 was then able to image the lens, because A is where the lens would have been in 1995, and B is where the lens is now. So basically, this is the background star, and this, we think, is the lens. And of course, when the lensing event happened, they were exactly aligned, so they would have been right on top of each other. But now they've moved a bit, or the lens has, and Hubble can see that. So that's, again, quite an interesting way in which we can at least help to convince ourselves after the fact that it really was a microlensing event. Again, it's just the extremely high resolution of Hubble that lets us do that. Okay, so we're going to talk more about lensing next week and the contribution of the Hubble telescope to gravitational lensing on much bigger scales. I'd better stop now and let the poor janitors get home after a long day. Okay, thank you very much. See you all next week.